funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do animals have souls? Many devoted pet owners say absolutely. Many traditional religions say absolutely not. Writer and farmer John Katz's menagerie includes donkeys, sheep, herding dogs, an affectionate but murderous cat, and a gigantic bull named Elvis with a taste for king-size Snickers bars. He's helped give birth to some of his animals, rather birth some of his animals, nursed some back from illness and injury, and watched others die. And while their lives may not have the same meaning as those of humans, Katz has taken to contemplating whether their purpose extends beyond the work they perform or the food they provide. His newest book is called Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. John, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
You've asked a lot of people this question about whether animals have souls, and I'm wondering if it strikes you how often they are not at all ambivalent. They're not stuck in the middle. They either say yes or they say no.
Well, what struck me is they almost always say yes, and that's a radical change. And, you know, what prompted the book, I saw a Harvard study 30 years ago that asked people whether their pets had souls, and almost all of them said no, it was ridiculous, absolutely not. And 3 years ago, they did the same survey, and it was exactly the opposite. 98% of people said, of course they do. And I've been asking this question on book tours and things for a couple of years now, and I really don't think I've met anyone who said no. And I thought it was fascinating, the shift, that there could be so seismic a shift in such an interesting issue, which people have been writing about, Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas, for thousands of years. That's what prompted me to take a look at the subject, was what prompted that change.
Do you think people now define a soul in a way that's broader than simply the thing that might go on to whatever afterlife you believe in?
Well, there are two or three things happening, I think. One is the Americans, feelings, emotional attachment to their pets is intensifying at just an astonishing rate. I mean, we're really redefining our relationships with a number of species, especially dogs and cats. And we view them very differently. You know, I went back and read, you know, Plato and Aristotle, who wrote about this, and I have to say, I discovered why they have endured. You know, they're pretty good. I'd never read them before. And they were writing quite obsessively about this question, you know, 8,000 years ago. And the feeling then was that what was sacred about humans was their soul, was their spirit, their conscience, their ability to do good and govern their lives. And animals don't have that. And so the feeling was that the human soul was precious, and you couldn't really compare it to an animal. And animals, of course, at the time were really essentially food and used for work. Relatively few of them were pets. In our time, it's quite the opposite. I think regard for humans is diminishing, and regard for animals is increasing. So people want their animals, wherever they're going, they want their animals to go with them. They want their animals to go to heaven, and they see them as superior to people and loving and wonderful and precious. And I think I've seen, when you go through the research, this remarkable shift in how humans are viewed and how animals are viewed. It's just flipped.
Later philosophers, like Thomas Aquinas, sort of codified what Aristotle and Plato had been thinking about and made it part of Christian doctrine.
Exactly. Almost every of the early Christian thinkers, who were quite an amazing group of writers, really, and thinkers and philosophers. They were not particularly dogmatic. They were quite open. I mean, they did follow dogma. But they were very interesting. They were really writing the first nonfiction writers in the world. And they all really wrote. Aquinas was very influential in shaping Christian and Western religions. This the same view applies in Judaism, really, and in the Muslim faith as well. That animals are not like people, and their souls cannot be compared to people. It's almost blasphemous to do that. That the soul is what ascends to heaven. The soul is what is precious. You go to heaven when you accept Jesus, or you accept the Lord, or you accept a particular God. You don't go by being an animal. And that became, is today, the bedrock view of Christian thought. There are some sort of runaway Christian theologists now, Andrew Lindsay and others, who are arguing that animals are equal to people and they have souls too, and they will also ascend. I sort of approached it from a more secular point of view, which is the regular dictionary definition of a soul, which is the animating spirit. I, of course, have no idea who's going to heaven and who isn't, and I wouldn't take up that, But the animating spirit of an animal, I mean, that's really the secular definition of a soul or of a person. And I look through my own animals and at society at why do we need to have this discussion? Why do we need them to have souls? Why do we want them to have souls? What do they mean to us now?
Yeah, I think the question of souls and sort of good and evil is interesting, as you write about your barn cat, who's named Mother.
Right.
And she doesn't kill simply for nourishment. She, as you describe it, sort of kills for sport. I mean, is that sort of amorality, an indication of her soul, or how do you wrestle with those two different ideas?
Well, that was great. It's one of my favorite chapters, I have to say. It's one of my friends who always loves cats, and she's always telling me that her cats are like her children, that they're just like children. And I thought, well, all right, I better take a look. If people are comparing cats and dogs to children, I want to take a look at one. So I spent the Christmas afternoon watching Mother, my barn cat, who is extremely affectionate to me. She's always coming up and rubbing her against me and wanting to come in the house and wanting a cuddle, and we're really quite close, but I never really paid that much attention to her. Barn cats are very independent. And so I spent several hours following her around and watching her, and I have to say it was quite an education for me. It was like watching Ted Bundy. I've been around a lot of animals, but I've never been around animals who take so much exquisite pleasure in catching, killing, dismembering, and torturing things. I mean, the body count was just piling up, you know, birds and mice and molds and chipmunks. And
far more than she can eat.
Far more than she can eat. And she was killing them with just exquisite joy and torture. And I was watching with my border collie, Rose, and the two of us were just agog. And then when she was done, she came wandering over and hopped in my lap and wanted to scratch and was purring at me. And so I thought to myself, well, okay, they're not like children, really, are they? and they're very affectionate, very wonderful, and that's what cats do. There's nothing evil about it. I mean, that's what they do. But it reminded me to be cautious about drawing these analogies between animals and children too far. That, you know, what makes them to me precious is that they're different. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an amazing creature who lives out in a barn by herself, doesn't want to live in the house, and is very savvy, deals with coyotes and foxes and raccoons and weather and winter, and handles all of it. And yet, what she does for fun is torture things. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, if she's like us, I better call the police. So it was interesting to me to remind me that, I think the philosophers were right in the sense that, you know, they're different. It's not that they're better or worse, or we're better or worse. And these comparisons can be dangerous. But they're different than us. And you know, cats don't wake up in the morning and say, how am I going to improve the world today? What am I going to do about global warming? You know, how can I be a better cat? And so I think that even though we often don't live up to expectations either, I think, you know, Plato would say that it was our ability to be better that makes us unique. And so be careful about comparing us to any animal.
Well, you know, that whole idea, John, makes me think about the fact that we have sort of we've created for ourselves rather a limited definition of soul. And you mentioned what you read in the dictionary, which is the animating spirit. You don't hear people talking often about the fact that maybe there are two different types of souls.
And maybe many more, really. I mean, you know, and of course, I haven't talked to anybody, really, which surprised me, except some ministers who argues the idea of an animal having a soul. And of course, if enough people believe it, it becomes the truth. But I think when it depends, you know, if you're saying, well, an animal has a soul like us, and my dog is going to heaven, it's one thing. I sort of came around, and it's an individual thing. I came around to sort of saying, for me, the soul of a dog or cat is the impact they have on my life. It's the way in which I love them, the way in which my border collie helps me run the farm, and I feel safe around her. Yeah, the way in which I have Lenore, the love dog, who's a lab, who just keeps love alive somehow, you know, just a creature of affection. And that would be her animating spirit to me, her soul. I also am somewhat disturbed, I guess, about the growing tendency of people to equate animals of all kinds with children and with people.
We should say you've raised a child.
Yes, I have a child.
And it is sort of a different thing. I always laugh about the phenomenon of new parents, certain that they'll feel exactly the same attention and attentiveness to a pet, and then a new baby comes along, and the relationship sort of shifts in a way.
Right. Well, the two big groups of pet acquirers are young couples before they have kids, and then empty nesters when the kids are gone. Those are the two big groups that acquire dogs and cats.
Though it would seem at least maybe we use animals as a proxy for children.
I think we use animals in all kinds of ways. You know, we see them as a warm-up for children. They're kind of a practice. They're a replacement for children. I think more and more people are seeing them as the same thing. I mean, the idea that animals are not children has actually become controversial. I mean, I hear people tell me all the time, my animals are just like my kids. They're my kids. And I think it's a question of perspective. What's going on between Americans and domestic animals is unprecedented in the history of the world, and it doesn't occur anywhere else in the world, even in England, to the degree that it's occurring here. You know, in China, they eat dogs, and here, you know, there's a tremendous growing feeling that dogs and cats are emotional surrogates, they're our best friends, they're therapists, they're spiritual. So you get into all of these soul questions, and I think probably the soul of a lot of dogs would be the way in which people love and need them. Then you go off, of course, in thinking, scratching your head, and saying, okay, what does it say about a culture in which so many people are turning to animals for so much affection? And have we really thought about that? Do we really have? I was on a program the other day where some woman said she just spent $20,000 to help her Jack Russell get through a series of medical problems. And I said, well, what's the limit on what you would spend? She said, there is no limit. There's nothing I wouldn't do. And I think we've gone to a place I don't know that we've really thought about. You know, it's not for me to tell anybody else how to think about it, but I think sometimes we've gone so far in such an accelerating way with our feeling about these animals that it might be good to just slow down a bit and think about where we're heading.
You know, a lot of people talk about the unconditional love that they feel from their pets, and there's a lot of questions as to whether that's fully a two-way street or really something that we project and then draw back. Do you think, though, that keeping animals as pets and in our lives, which most people would argue is very often a good thing, does it, though, make it easier to sort of avoid the more difficult human relationships in our lives?
Well, it's such a great question. It's such a great issue. You know, I think unconditional love is something everybody says they love about a dog or a cat. Excuse me. And I think about unconditional love, and I think unconditional love to me is not really very worthwhile because it's unconditional. You know, I think there should be conditions on love. If I want someone to love me, I have to do certain things. I have to be thoughtful, and I have to be sensitive, and I have to be a free will. And I just don't get it and keep it. With a dog, you know, there's all kinds of studies and feelings about this. Dogs tend to love us really because we feed them. And
nobody likes to think of it that way.
Nobody likes to think of it that way. And you know, most dogs, everybody says, well, you know, your dog would wither and die without you. And that's not true. You know, millions and millions of dogs are rehomed every year very happily. And if they get fed and shelter and attention, they're usually pretty content. And if it wasn't, you know, if love was unconditional, millions of rescue dogs would wither and die. And they're animals, you know, so they what's really important to them is food and sustenance. And to me, that doesn't diminish it. It doesn't mean they don't love me. It's just they don't love me in the human way. And it's unconditional in the sense that, you know, your dog may love you, but your dog would love me too if I had enough hamburger.
Maybe that's what we love about them, though, that simplicity, that it's not so complicated and it's not about what you'll achieve in your life or you know, your ability to look good on the dance floor. It's simply you give this very simple thing and you get back something that feels much more valuable.
Well, I think that is what I love about them. I love about them that they're dependable and elemental and they're simple. And they don't, you know, file lawsuits and scream at cable talk shows and send nasty messages on the Internet. You know, and that's what I love about them. I love that they're not like us. You know, in that way, I think they're much more simple and they're much more dependable.
John Katz is with us. His new book is called Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment and invite you to join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer and farmer John Katz is with us today. His new book is called Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. If you'd like to be part of our discussion, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You, John, have a probably much wider experience with different kinds of animals than a lot of people who are listening and have had sort of house pets. But I do think it's very interesting that many of us can speak easily about dogs and cats and even horses and maybe apes having souls. You don't hear a lot of people losing sleep over whether a mackerel or a salamander or an eel has a soul. And I wonder if you're comfortable with the idea that some animals may be more soulful than others.
Well, it's a great question. I actually think that some animals are just better at manipulating us than others. I mean, the reason that raccoons and mackerels don't get to sleep in our bedrooms is that they don't know how to handle us. They don't know how to react to us. They don't know how to look us in the eye and wag their tails and come up and cuddle and jump next to the sofa and give us licks. And dogs are probably, along with cats, the greatest manipulators in the animal world. And that's why they've survived and thrived so well. You know, we're not nice to most species. We don't treat them very well. And the difference between a squirrel and a raccoon is how they interact with us. They run away from us. They hide from us. They don't like us. Dogs have for thousands of years been handling us. They've been reading our emotions. They're very good at reading human emotions. They get us to love them. They know how to look at us. They know how to get us to feed them. And they're great scholars of food. And, you know, there's a great, Brian Hare of Harvard did this great study on why people love dogs. And he said, well, people love dogs because dogs know people better than any other animal and know how to get us to react to things. And I think that's really the line. I think, and that doesn't, again, to me, doesn't diminish it. They're very skilled at it. That doesn't mean that they're thinking in human terms, God, I really love this guy. I want to be loyal to him. You know, the central idea most people have of a dog is the Disney dog. And this is the dog you see in all the Disney movies that if the dog gets lost, we'll go 800 miles across the Arctic tundra to find you. My dogs are not Disney dogs. If they were lost, they would go to a deli and they would stay there and they'd be very happy, or maybe a sheep farm. And again, I think it's very important. What you're really talking about is not diminishing the love, but understanding the love. You know, they're animals, so they react differently. And I understand whenever I'm training an animal or getting to know it, whether it's a cow or a goat or a donkey, they all are very fond of me, and they're all very fond of me for the same reason. I feed them. And they pay incredible amount of attention to the people that feed them. They know where I am. They know when I come out. When I go out in the morning, I'm greeted by a chorus of baas and moos and barks because I've got the food. Now, and I don't kid myself into thinking it's because I'm a nice guy. You know, and I treat them well, certainly, and I care about that. But I think, you know, again, it doesn't bother me. That doesn't take it away. I think we need to be careful as we're defining our relationship with these animals not to put more on them than they deserve, because when you treat a dog like an animal, you're not always being good to it. You know, dogs die from overfeeding. There are 300,000 dogs on Prozac. You know, you can love a dog too much and in the wrong way, and it's really something to be careful about.
Well, you know, the idea that they love you because, again, you provide for them is both empowering and humbling. On the one hand, you can be the most important creature in an animal's life. And yet, as you say, if they run away and some kind person takes them in, you're maybe a distant memory. And that's very humbling.
Interestingly, I gave some of my donkeys away recently to a farmer in Vermont who had need of them. And I was paring down the number of animals here. And I gave him away, and I was, you know, so, oh my God, are they going to be okay? And I was calling him up, and I went over to see him 2 weeks later. And boy, were they happy. they were in this farm family and some 4-H kids, and there were all kinds of horses around. They were getting fresh hay every morning and cookies, and they were pretty happy. And they gave me a look, and they gave me a little sniff, and that was about it. So, I mean, the adaptability of animals is probably their most universal feature. And they, you know, animals adapt to weather, to different climate, to being rehomed, to being moved, you know, and they don't wither away when they're disconnected from us, and that's important because, you know, it means that if you find a better home for them, they ought to go. It's okay. They can be left alone. You know, we don't have to put all that charge into it. We can have some perspective.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. John Katz is with us. His new book is called Soul of a Dog. Let's go to Jeannie in Dallas. Hello, Jeannie.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent.
Hi.
Hi. First, I want to thank you for two things that I've already heard on the program. The first is that you mentioned how this conversation has shifted and evolved since way back from the times of Aristotle and Plato. That's number one. The second thing was when you said that when you talk about this subject, how you have learned to speak about it saying, well, from my experience, or this is what, you know, this is how I view things. And as an adjunct to that, I just wanted to share another perspective, possibly a shifting perspective, that it may not sound like much of a difference. And when we change the words, instead of saying, I have a soul or animals have soul, if we say, I am soul and I have a body, it can really change the conversation. And I'd like to hear your thoughts about that. And also, I'd like to recommend the book, Animals Are Soul Too, by Harold Klimt.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
I think it's a very lovely perspective, and I certainly understand what you're saying, and I think it has a lot of meaning. I think in our country, and I think you're saying somewhat the same thing, in our country, all these issues are presented in terms of arguments. You know, you can't turn on TV or radio without hearing two sides of everything screaming at each other. And I think these are individual choices. You know, an animal is whatever somebody wants it to be. And if you want your dog to have a soul, or you are soul, that's your choice. And so I don't really write from a perspective of telling people what to think or telling them that they're wrong. I've had the good fortune to be living with these animals for 5 or 6 years on a farm in upstate New York. And I've found they have very powerful spirits, and their spirits affect me very powerfully. And so for me, the soul of all these creatures is the impact they have on me. I'm very fond of the 3,000-pound Swiss steer named Elvis. And I go visit him in the pasture, and he's very fond of me because I bring him apples and Dunkin' Donuts and things.
And Snickers bars.
And Snickers bars. He's very he loves chocolate. Don't give him too much.
Yeah, he was getting overweight for a while because you loved him so much.
It was hard to. And he's a master manipulator. He would come out at noon and moo at me through at my study window, and I would go running out and give him food, thinking he was hungry. And, you know, why else would he be standing there mooing at me? And it took me a couple of months to figure out who the dumb beast was in the equation.
Well, and you're right here, and I think this is hilarious, that he sort of charmed his way out of the slaughterhouse.
Several times. He is a farmer who in 45 years had never failed to put a cow on a truck to market, and he couldn't put Elvis on the truck. He just couldn't do it because he's got these big brown eyes and he loves people. Then he was supposed to go to the slaughterhouse, and the slaughterhouse guy wouldn't put him on the truck. And, of course, they looked around for somebody dumb enough to take him, and that ended up being me. And, he's a very sweet creature. I used to go out and read poems to him until he ate the poem. He ate the book of poems. And again, I don't fool myself. You know, he's really sweet to everybody and likes a lot of everybody who feeds him. He's very, very. But I do see that these animals do have lives. They do have relationships. He's very fond of one of the cows. He loves to be with them. He's definitely got a spirit that is very unique and very precious to me.
Can you talk about your chicken, Henrietta?
Henrietta the hen, yes. Henrietta, sometimes these animals just go off in these very inexplicable directions. And the chickens are really, to me, among the least interesting of creatures. I mean, they just go around all day and eat bugs and peck, and I just don't think about them much. This one, Henrietta, just suddenly became quite the personality. She wanted to come in the house. She came waiting by the back door in the morning for me. She loved to hop up on the backs of donkeys and ride around with them. She became very friendly with some of the dogs and liked to chase around the yard with them, which is can be a dangerous thing to do with border collie. And she, unfortunately, was a little too boisterous. She ran across the road and hit by a car. But she had such a distinct personality. She was so different from all of the other chickens, and I just, for the life of me, couldn't fathom why. She just was very curious and was very attached to people, and she loved one of the donkeys, and every time I would go out, I would see her on the donkey's back riding around, which is a really strange thing to see. But I couldn't begin to tell you what was going on. When I would go out in the morning, she'd be sitting by the stoop, and she'd follow me around like a dog. And some of it was food because I fed her, but some of it was she just liked to have a good time. And if anything was going on, if people came over, she would hop up on the porch and like cluck around and flap her wings. So I think it's the other interesting thing about animals is when they behave in these completely unpredictable, inexplainable ways. And again, I have no idea what was going on with her.
Well, you know, in a book about the souls of animals, it struck me, John, that when she was killed, and you were very fond of her, you still chose not to bury her.
Yes. I think being a... I'm not really a farmer. I mean, I have a farm, but, you know, my crop is really stories, you know, and I don't really have to go through what the farmers have to go through. But your perspective on animals changes very dramatically. I mean, there's really no such thing as a no-kill farm. You know, you just can't do it. And you know, animals come and animals go, and you learn a lot about life and death on a farm. And so I'm very conscious of, you know, farmers were really horrified at the idea of chickens being pets. So when Henrietta died, somebody actually emailed me and said, I wrote about it on my blog, and they said, well, are you going to have a burial? And I didn't. I went and threw her out in the woods and left her for the coyotes and all. It just seemed to me that it was inappropriate to have a burial for a chicken. And I think those boundaries are important because as fond as I was of her, as much as I appreciated her, you know, I mean, it's almost an offense to real farmers to have a burial right for a chicken. So I think that idea, you know, at the same time, I was embarrassingly good to her and fond of her. But I think that perspective is very important, you know, that you know, for a lot of farmers struggle so hard, and it was hard enough for them to figure out what I was doing with a border collie here. Because, you know, I have a border collie for the sheep, but nobody else has a border collie because nobody can afford one. So I think that line is very important. You know, I think on a real farm, you know, you have to be careful about getting into too much rescue or too much veterinary work. You just can't afford it. And if you do get into it too much, you're not going to have a farm for long.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Gabriel in Arlington. Hey, Gabriel.
Hi. Excuse me. My question, I work as a veterinary technician in an emergency clinic. So on a day-to-day basis, I see many different types of relationships that people have with their pets. And what has kind of something that I have started to think about a lot since I began in this field, seeing people euthanize their animals, you know, for economic reasons or just because it's unfair to have that animal, you know, if it's in such a bad state to continue life because quality of life has gone down so far. And it's just has been interesting to me to start thinking about, you know, why is it so accepted to humanely euthanize our pets and sort of give them that release in, you know, dire situations, but not for humans. And I was just wondering what your opinion is on that.
That's a wonderful question, and you probably see a lot of things that make you think quite a bit from your perspective. Well, it's a great question because I think we're viewing, you know, we see ourselves as having life or death control over animals, and I think animals are not, also don't really get into the religious issues that get involved with the euthanizing people or any human suffering. You know, and probably religion is the biggest reason why it's not applied to people in this country. The question of euthanizing, and I think your perspective is probably more interesting than mine on it. People are really in a quandary right now, not only because of the economy, but because of their emotional attachments, as I'm sure you see. They have no idea what to do when a dog is sick or suffering, or when to end it, or how far to go, or how much money to spend. And they really struggle with it. What I see, and you may see this too, is extraordinary grief, just really traumatic, serious grief at the death of a dog or cat. That goes on for years and years and years. I mean, many people tell me they can't get another dog, even though there are millions of dogs that would need a home, because they can't go through that again. So I think what's happening is people are more and more beginning to see dogs and cats and pets as being like people, and to equate the loss of them as similar to the loss of a person. I'd be interested to know if you find that in what you see.
We have an email here from Dormand in Dallas, and this is something that I know you know something about. Dormand writes that his 82-year-old sister's life was deeply enriched by the gift of her son of a tiny dachshund named Petey, who has almost eliminated the depression that accompanied the loss of her spouse. You have worked with two of your dogs in hospice care.
Yes, well, dogs have amazing impact on people's psyche, absolutely, and cat and other pets too. Izzy, my border collie, works in hospice work with me, and my last book, Izzy and Lenore, was about that. It's amazing to me. We'll walk into a home where someone is dying, and he'll light it up just by being there. Part of that's that we're paying attention and somebody came, and part of that is animals touch something very deep in people and awaken them. Other side of it, and of course there's many sides to all of this, I think we live in a culture where people are not always taking good care of other people. And I get a little nervous sometimes at the comfort with which we want to turn it over to dogs. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of therapy dogs now, and that's great. It's wonderful stuff. They do wonderful work, and I think it's very nice. But I often go into nursing homes with Izzy, and I often see the directors will say the same thing to me, which kind of has got my attention. They'll say, well, it's great that you're here with the dog, but we wish the families would come once in a while. And so I think again, if you're stepping back and looking at this issue, there's no doubt that animals have an extraordinary therapeutic impact on people who are sick and depressed, and they do wonderful work. But is that really, that's new work for animals. I mean, that's a new thing for them. And I think in my own experience, you want to be careful, I think, not to turn it over to them. I think when only animals are involved, it makes me a little nervous. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The idea that we sort of let ourselves off the hook and assume that we can't do what an animal could do.
And also that I think we're sometimes attributing more to the animals than is really possible. You know, we read all about the cat who knows when people are going to die, and animals who can smell cancer, and animals who can, and I think we need to protect them from all of this pressure and responsibility, that there are just great limits on what they can do. And we certainly, you know, I learned that in hospice. You know, you can't turn people's lives around. You can't make them happy, and you can't save their lives.
John Katz is with us. His newest book is called Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer John Katz. His newest book is called Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. It has struck me before, John, that all of your books about your animals are actually books about human beings. And I wonder if you recognize that from the moment you set out to write in this way on these subjects, or if it took you a while to sort of see into that.
No, I appreciate that, and I think it's very perceptive. I remember saying when I wrote my first dog book, A Dog Year, I remember thinking to myself, well, these books are not about dogs. They're about people. Because whenever you write about dogs, you're writing about people. You're writing about the impact that dogs have on people and the way they affect people's lives. And all these things we're talking about, you know, souls, religion, sick people, depressed people, they're all about people. I mean, I think you see in the spectrum of dogs this enormous human need. And I think that's the reason, that's the difference. That's what Gabriel was talking about. People need dogs and cats in a profound way that they did not used to need them. I mean, if you think about the life of the dog 30 or 40 years ago, they never had human names. They didn't sleep in bed. They didn't go to the vet. There wasn't even dog food until 1960. They ate garbage. And now if you feed dog food to your dogs, you're abusive. So I think that this relationship has done nothing but intensifying, and I think it's always really, in my time, in my experience as a writer, been about need and human need, and including the need of humans to see their dogs as having souls, which is, you know, I wove in this book a lot about my border collie, Rose.
Yeah.
And there was a great example of a dog that I kept saying, well, I can't live here without Rose. I can't live on this farm without Rose. And one day I was kind of thinking about it, and I noticed that there was no other rows around. If other farmers wanted their sheep to come, they just shook a cup of grain. They didn't have any border collie. And I realized that my view of her was the reason I felt safe being here. I didn't want to do this alone. I was too frightened about it. I'm just too fearful a person to go buy a farm by myself. And that was an eye-opener for me, because I realized that Rose wasn't having this debate about souls. She didn't need that. I needed it.
And in fact, she doesn't seem to need your affection in the way your other dogs do.
No, she needs to work, and she needs to, she's not into treats, and she doesn't like a lot of attention, and she doesn't want to cuddle, she doesn't want to sleep in bed, and she doesn't bat her eyes at me. She's just very focused, and she's actually, by the way, inspired. I'm actually switching to fiction, back to fiction, and I'm just finished a novel coming out next year called Rose in a Storm, which is about a border collie who's abandoned on a farm in a storm with animals and has to deal with it. And I'm writing it from the point of view of the dog, which was probably the most difficult thing I've ever done.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's so interesting because I know that you work really hard, and it's challenging for all of us not to anthropomorphize, and I wonder how you can write from the perspective of a dog without doing just that.
Well, that's a great question. That's what made it so difficult, because I decided I'm not going to, the dog doesn't think and the dog doesn't have words. So I work with behaviorists very, very intensely, and with my editor very intensely. I call it the rubber book, because it kept coming back to me. Every time I sent it out, it came flying back to me. I have an editor who's just like Rose. I guess she's not listening to this program. She is exactly like Rose, and which is good for me. But, incredibly determined and very tough, but also very loving and vulnerable. And she really got the character. And so what I ended up doing was, there's nothing in the book that a dog couldn't theoretically do. So I found in my research that dogs actually think very much like autistic people think in terms of sensory images. And Temple Grandin has written a lot about this. And so I had her character really, she just acts. And so the book is narrated through her actions. But there's no point at which she's actually saying, I'm sad or I'm happy or I'm whatever. So I think I was faithful to that idea. I think the challenge of the book was to have a central character narrating the book who doesn't talk.
Yeah,
and I got to tell you, that was tough.
Well, it's a fascinating idea, because I have to tell you, reading about Rose, and she appears in multiple places in this book, the image that I kept coming away with was that she reminded me of the studies I've read of people, not so much with autism, but with Asperger syndrome.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a very interesting perception. Well, it's not a bad analogy. I mean, Rose is really all about work. And she's, grown up on, unlike most dogs, Rose has had to make decisions her whole life. The American dog is actually, having trouble getting smarter, because they don't get to do anything anymore. They don't walk, they don't hunt, they don't eat. They really just are walked on leash and are given food, so they don't really have to make a lot of choices. Rose has to make choices every day. She deals with belligerent rams and rebellious donkeys. And so I've seen her evolve quite a bit. I mean, it's been one of the most fascinating parts of my time here. And we were out there today in the pasture, and I didn't notice this, of course. And she turns, and there's a fawn stuck in the gate. And I didn't even see it. And Rose goes up, keeping her distance. And there was this amazing hour and a half, which I was trying to get the fawn out of the gate. The fawn is lashing out with the hooves, so it can be very dangerous to get too close to. And Rose just began moving in and distracting the fawn, getting on the other side of the fawn and turning her head away from me. I didn't tell her to do this. I wouldn't have thought of it. And she just kept repeating this until the fawn became focused on her, turned away from me, and I got a picture of this, actually, and I could reach in and lift up the latch and free the fawn. And Rose never went too close to her, never went after her, never chased her, never got within range of her hoofs, and I trusted her completely. So I've seen this kind of problem solving 100 times with this dog. And yet if you went up to try to say, Rose, you're so cute, come cuddle with me, she'd growl at you. And I don't know where she sleeps. So it is an amazing thing. I think part of her story is that she's had the opportunity her whole life to just get smarter and more decisive, and I've seen her do it. So that was the inspiration for the character. But I also don't anthropomorphize her. She doesn't get up in the morning and say, I'm sad today, and I also understand, I've left instructions of all my friends, if anything happened to me, take her to a sheep farm and throw her over the fence.
Because that's where she'll thrive.
She'll be fine. She'll absolutely be fine. And you know, and she's not the most likable dog I've ever had, but she's absolutely the most admirable.
John Katz is my guest. His new book is called Soul of a Dog. Let's go next to Dan in Dallas. Hello, Dan.
Hello, thank you. So many comments, but I know that I have a soul. I may be surprised at the end of this ride. But as to whether the dogs and cats have known, the ones that I've shared my soul with, I know they do. To the rest of them, not so sure. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Well, I mentioned in the book, I think, I had a Baptist minister come and visit the farm. Reverend Whitbread, to come and help me with this question. And he was great. He came right up to Lulu, one of my donkeys, and he looked her right in the eye, and he said, Lulu, do you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior?
And Lulu said nothing.
Lulu said, no, look at him. He's looking for a cookie, as she always expects anybody. She always wants the cookie. And he patted her on the nose, and he said, she's not going to heaven. And so he was very clear. You know, he said Christian theology is not ambiguous on this issue. You know, there's one way to go to heaven, and there's no other way. And that's, you know, and I admired him because I think he was very clear about, you know, his own faith. If you get away from religion, it's just, you get into, just as Dan said, it's really up to the individual. You know, it's not up to me. It's up to everybody to kind of make their own judgment about it. I think the interesting question is, why do we need them to have souls? You know, why do we need that? And that need is very new.
Did you conclude ultimately that we, you know, it's almost like one of those tree falling in the forest questions. An animal doesn't have a soul until there's someone, some sentient creature that recognizes that within them.
Well, that's what's happening. You know, in our culture, the belief of animals having souls is now nearly universal. And so that, to me, makes it true, you know, because if everybody believes it, it's true. And I think that's what's happening. I think our need for them is so great, and the conviction about this so intense, that the idea that they may not have a human-style soul has almost become a fringe idea. And so I think that's what's so interesting about it, is how we got from there to there in such a short time. And no other culture in the world has taken that point of view, and we never did either until very recently. So I think if you, in all the dog writing, I think we've talked about this before, in all the dog writing, as you go back and look at it, you see what parallels it is this, I see it's this great human disconnection. You know, work is uncertain for people. Politics are divisive and uninspiring generally. Technology is a real pain in the neck for everybody. And it doesn't make our lives always easier. It makes it very complicated. And religion is in a shaky place for many of us. So I think we really need this fixed point. And, you know, you come home and a dog is happy to see you, period, as you mentioned earlier. I don't care what you look like or smell like or what you're wearing or how you did at work. You're going to see that dog as loving you unconditionally, and that means the world to people. And I think that's where this comes from. It comes from complex times. You know, when the economy started up, everybody was talking about, oh, my God, all these dogs are going to be abandoned, and some of them have been. But there's also been a huge spike in adoption because people need them more. And you see this really, this deepening thread in American life.
I wonder, too, if there's something to the fact that, you know, there are a lot of people today who believe in heaven who don't believe in hell. And I wonder if maybe as the idea of us having to sort of earn our way into something that comes after this life, as that falls away or takes a different form, it becomes easier to visualize an animal which doesn't make any moral decisions one way or another as being right there along with us.
Well, I think yes. I think people just can't imagine. They want them to go. You know, they want the company. You know, they just want them to go. And I also think what I came away with from reading these early philosophers, including the Christian thinkers and the philosophers as well, they thought they were very excited about the human prospect. At that time in which Plato and Aristotle were writing, they were just inventing democracy. They were inventing culture. They were inventing drama. And so they thought the humans were just really on the way up. They were coming out of the, you know, a dark period of tribalism and war and misery. And so they really thought that human souls were sacred, and animals were just things you had to carry wood around and plowed. In our time, I think you've seen a great reverse, and I don't think we're disenchanted with people. We don't consider people. We consider people as mucking up the world and making a mess of things and engaged in mindless wars and bloody wars. And animals don't do any of those things. Animals are at least domestic ones, are just, we perceive them as being loving and pure. So I think that view is really accelerating. It makes sense when you think of that, that, of course, they're going to go to heaven. They're better than we are.
Time here for one more quick call, and that comes from Sherry in Fort Worth. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about the capacity for emotional attachment that was addressed earlier. I think that that really varies widely from animal to animal, and my main experience is with dogs, so I'm mainly talking about that. But at one point in time, I had 7 dogs, and I do agree that 5 of them could have been taken and plopped down in another household, and they would have been perfectly happy with, you know, a soft bed and a bowl of food. But 2 of them, I really think, would not have been happy. And I know of one instance where a dog that I knew personally just quit. It was a dog that I had as a child, quit eating after her dog companion died and never would eat again and died not very long afterwards. And I have a friend who's a rescuer, and I know of another instance where a dog that she took in as a rescue, whose owner had died, never recovered and died shortly thereafter, you know, she says, from grief, of course.
Yeah.
You know,
sure,
but I think that it really does vary. I think that, you know, we don't want to paint animals too much with a broad brush, just like individual humans vary greatly in their capacity for intelligence and their compassion.
I need to stop you there because I want to make sure that we have time for John to respond. You made some points that I think a lot of people can relate to. And John, I know you must have heard many stories like what Sherry's telling us.
Well, it's a very good point. It's very thoughtful. I think 2 things. One, there are all kinds of reasons why a dog might stop eating, you know, anxiety, confusion, you know, fear, bewilderment. You know, dogs are creatures of routine, and they do get traumatized when the routine changes. But those stories are just statistically so rare and not the norm. The Katrina experience, I mean, every year 12 million dogs in America are rehomed through rescue. And hardly any of them are known to starve themselves to death. It's just almost unheard of. So, you know, just so many dogs are rehomed, so many different contexts. Every time there's a hurricane, you know, every year all over the place. And the vast majority of them, you know, there's behavioral issues come up and all, but for a dog to stop eating because they're just moved to a new place is really, really, really on the edge of the spectrum. I'm not saying it can't happen or that it's not meaningful when it does. And even when it does happen, we don't really know what the motives are. You know, we attribute certain kinds of human motives because that's what we know, but their minds are alien.
John Katz is a writer and a farmer. His newest book is called Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals at Bedlam Farm. John, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Terrific program. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.